Welcome back. I'm Todd Zwillick. A crime on its face usually looks pretty clear-cut. A drug deal gone bad, a robbery, somebody punches a cop and gets jail time for it. Then there are the cases where things aren't quite what they seem. Not confounding just to observers like you and me, but to the criminal justice system itself. Sometimes there are cases where the lurching gears and levers of justice just can't handle it. And The Takeaway is teaming up with the nonprofit news organization, The Marshall Project, for a new series called Case in Point. This week, it's the case of William Palmer, which raises a lot of questions about the meaning of criminal intent under the law. Now, it all began back in 2009. Palmer's girlfriend, Kay Anderson, saw that he was behaving erratically and strangely. She decided it was best to hide the guns in their home. When William Palmer couldn't find his guns, he called 911 to report them stolen. And according to court documents, Palmer then gave the phone to Anderson, who told the operator she feared for her safety. State troopers were dispatched to the residence right away. And when they got there, they found Palmer brandishing an assault rifle.
The problem for police and prosecutors is that Palmer's bizarre behavior didn't end when he was arrested. He went immediately to jail. There was an initial hearing. The judge who saw him hours after the incident was so alarmed by his behavior that he basically ordered a competency hearing. Palmer was defecating on tables and smearing his own feces around. He clearly was not in his right mind, so much so that he eventually ended up that very day at the hospital where he was diagnosed as having a brain aneurysm that had ruptured into a brain hemorrhage. So essentially on the day that he has this problem with the police, he is suffering from brain damage that is so severe that he has to have emergency surgery. Prosecutors know it happens, and they still continue to press the case against him. The initial report from a state psychologist was that he still, days later, a couple of weeks later, was disoriented and didn't really understand what had happened. A second evaluation, a little bit further down the road, showed that his injury had cleared up a little bit. He was now more oriented and thus competent to stand trial. So the prosecutor knows all of this, and yet the trial proceeds down the road.
Right. Well, I mean, we're used to hearing about cases where people claim to be not legally culpable because of mental illness or psychotic breaks, things like that, not guilty by reason of insanity. Those things might be familiar. But this seems, on the face of it, to be an open and shut case for the defense, right? Just go to the jury and say, here's the medical record. He was having an aneurysm, and these doctors over here will tell you that that can mess with your behavior.
So that's essentially what Palmer's lawyer wanted to argue. Hey, my guy isn't intellectually disabled in a long-term sense of the word. He doesn't have that cognitive problem and hasn't had it for years. He just had a medical condition, a physical condition that rendered his brain incapable of acting rationally, incapable of acting other than how he acted. Prosecutors disputed that. They did not want to hear that defense from Palmer. They said that he had to show mental disease or defect. That's another sort of prong in Alaska law. The reason prosecutors wanted that is because they wanted to require Palmer again to undergo more psychological evaluations, which he and his lawyers weren't willing to do. So you get this big pretrial fight going into this, what should have been a minor trial, over the nature of a medical condition and its impact and its effect on criminal intent, the idea of mens rea.
But what prevents Mr. Palmer's lawyers from going right to some neurologists to look at his CAT scans or his brain films or his medical history, whatever it is, and say, yeah, in my professional opinion, he had a big brain aneurysm, and that can make you aggressive and disoriented?
Well, what prevented the attorney from doing that in this case was the judge, who sided with prosecutors. Prosecutors now, so we know that they're going forward with a case in which they know there's been a brain hemorrhage. Now prosecutors move to basically block the defense from arguing that it was a brain hemorrhage that was responsible for the conduct. And the judge agrees and says, you know what, if you're not going to submit to these additional psychological evaluations, I'm not going to let you tell jurors that your client essentially was brain damaged on the day in question. The case proceeds to trial. Prosecutors get the state troopers to talk about how they thought that Palmer was acting drunk. And they said that they smelled alcohol on his breath. It's certainly possible that he was also drinking in addition to this brain hemorrhage. But the information comes out that Palmer is drunk. The jury is led to believe that Palmer is having a drunken episode when, in fact, the rest of us know that he wasn't.
Andrew, are there cases similar to this, or is this a very specific case of one judge in one jurisdiction depriving a jury of critical information about somebody's medical and psychological condition during a crime?
It's definitely an odd case. I've been covering these sorts of cases for a long time. I have not heard a scenario like this where even the state psychologist, right, is on board in saying that there has been this brain problem and having the case go to trial and having there be a conviction. Now, there's another twist in the story that listeners might be interested in. So the same judge who basically bars the defense from putting on the defense that they wanted to put on at sentencing says, you know what, I think that Mr. Palmer was suffering from a mental disease and defect, and I'm going to reflect that in the sentence I give him. I'm going to give him a 7-year sentence, but I'm going to suspend 6 of those years so that he only has to serve a year in jail. And so that's the mercy that Palmer got from the same judge who had basically blocked jurors from hearing the truth about the case. The reason we're still talking about it 7 years later is that there was an appeal. The defense said, wait a minute, we were essentially denied our constitutional right to a fair trial by not being able to put on our defense and by being required by the judge to choose between incriminating ourselves in this psychological evaluation or giving up the truth and the best defense that we had. So the Alaska courts are still wrangling with it, even though Mr. Palmer, as he nears the age of 70, is living presumably back in his home.
As a convicted felon.
And it's going to be fascinating to see how the Alaska courts deal with it. Everybody who was sort of around at the time has moved on. This is a very interesting issue, not just in Alaska, the idea of medical conditions impacting criminal intent. And of course, that's a universal theme that we're hearing about, not just in criminal cases, but really on the political scene in Washington with this big push for what's called mens rea reform on Capitol Hill.
Andrew Cohen is commentary editor at The Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. It's a biweekly column that sheds light on a single case or character from the criminal justice system.